Thanks for listening to the best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
We are 2 days away from the divisional round of the NFL playoffs, and I can't wait. Two games on Saturday, two games on Sunday. I imagine that many of you are also fired up about that. Plus, we're getting closer and closer to Monday's college football national championship game, going to be a really exciting and fun Saturday, Sunday, and Monday for those of us who absolutely love football. I am flying down to New Orleans on Sunday. So I'll be doing the show from Radio Row with the College Football National Championship on Monday and Tuesday from New Orleans. So that should be pretty fun. And the more I think about Joe Burrow versus Trevor Lawrence, the more unique that game becomes, in that I can't remember a big-time national championship game like this where you basically had two number one picks at quarterback going at it head-to-head. Now, in back-to-back years. So Joe Burrow, barring something crazy, is going to be the number one overall pick to the Cincinnati Bengals in 2020 in April, in a couple of months. And then in 2021, barring something else crazy, Trevor Lawrence will be the overall number one pick. And there's, again, we'll get into this a lot as we get closer and closer to that game. But Joe Burrow at 15-0, if LSU were able to win this game down in New Orleans, would become, I believe, the greatest quarterback in a single season in college football history. Right now, I've got Cam Newton as the greatest single college football season for any quarterback that I've ever seen. Cam Newton, the year he won the Heisman Trophy, the national championship, Auburn went 14-0. Might have been the greatest $180,000 ever paid in the history of athletics. Good move, Auburn. That is the greatest single season I've ever seen. But if Joe Burrow were able to win the national championship, get his LSU team to 15-0, beat another top 10 opponent, because he would have beaten Auburn, Florida, Georgia, Oklahoma, and Clemson, and Alabama, and not even counting Texas, who was top 10 earlier in the year but then fell off, that would be as good or better than any season that has ever occurred for any quarterback in college football history, I believe. Flip side, if Trevor Lawrence wins a second straight national championship, he would come back for his third year at Clemson chasing a third straight national championship and attempting to remain an undefeated starter for three straight years, which would probably make him the greatest college football quarterback of all time. Because we've never had anybody go undefeated for 3 years and win three straight national championships. So that in and of itself to follow would be incredible to see. So that's a big game. It's coming up on Monday. But in the meantime, we've got games on Saturday and we've got games on Sunday as they inch closer and closer to us. And what I am curious about as we look at the first Saturday game, Minnesota going up against the 49ers, Titans going up against the Ravens, Texans going up against Kansas City Chiefs, and Seattle on the road against Green Bay. Which quarterback has the most at stake? Of all eight of these quarterbacks that are still alive, which one has the most to gain and the most to lose down the stretch run of this season if they were to win a Super Bowl? And so I'm looking here thinking, okay, which ones have the most to gain? I think you take Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers. We started off the show yesterday talking about how I thought the matchup between Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers on Sunday night in Lambeau is actually being under sort of talked about. It's being undersold because each of these guys has won a Super Bowl and they are going head-to-head, big-time stars. We've talked for a long time about whether they might be able to get, particularly Aaron Rodgers, a second Super Bowl win. But they don't have the most at stake because we basically let it be known that you are a made man if you are able to go out and get that Super Bowl win. So I think you can take Aaron Rodgers and Russell Wilson out of the equation. I think so that leaves six guys who have the most at stake potentially. Then I think you start to factor in age. And look, I do believe that it's a big deal that Lamar Jackson needs to win a playoff game. If he were to lose two straight playoff games, then I do think there would be more doubters that would creep up. But he's 23 years old, and he's going to be the MVP, and he's going to be in the playoffs multiple years to come. So I think you take Lamar Jackson out of the equation, and I also think you do the same thing for Patrick Mahomes and for Deshaun Watson because all those guys are so young. And we know now Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson have won playoff games. So I don't think necessarily the pressure is ratcheted up as highly on them. And then, I'm really sitting here looking at it. I mean, Jimmy G is still relatively young as well. Kirk Cousins, I think the expectations are so low for he and Tannehill that it's hard for me to figure that out too. So as I'm sitting here looking who has the most to gain of any quarterback, it's clearly got to be one of the six that hasn't ever won a Super Bowl. But I feel like Kirk Cousins and Tannehill are playing with house money now because nobody really anticipated that they would be advancing. And also nobody really anticipates that much from them in general. But the more I think about it, the more I think this would be the most impressive for a guy like Kirk Cousins. Because if Kirk Cousins suddenly won a Super Bowl, then everything changes about his narrative almost overnight. Like, look, okay, yes, if Lamar Jackson goes on and he wins the MVP and he wins the Super Bowl, he's won a Super Bowl, he becomes a made man, but he's still only 23. So I don't know. I think his season has been so good otherwise. I don't think he has as much to gain. Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes, I feel like in general they have a great deal of commendation that already follows them. I think Kirk Cousins is the guy of the final eight that would stand to gain the most from winning a Super Bowl. And I believe that partly factors in that Kirk Cousins is probably the most criticized and reviled quarterback in the NFL right now. I don't know that there's anybody else who gets ripped more. You could maybe say Eli Manning, but I feel like Eli's probably the most criticized double Super Bowl winner ever, and I think partly that's a function of him playing in New York and being a Manning. So he's been in the public eye for 20-some-odd years now. But that in and of itself is an interesting question. Who has the most to gain here? I want to bring in the crew. My argument, Danny G, is that of the eight quarterbacks remaining, the guy whose resume changes the most, the guy whose public perception changes the most with a Super Bowl is Kirk Cousins. Do you buy that?
I do. I agree with you on Kirk Cousins, especially because of all that money he was given by the Skins, the way he was franchise tagged. He couldn't win. He couldn't get over the hump all those seasons. And we kept hearing, oh, he's one of those guys.
Can't win the big game.
Right. He's been stealing money. Finally, he gets that first playoff W. So you're right. I agree with you on Cousins. I actually think Lamar Jackson almost has the most to lose.
That's a decent argument. The only reason I didn't buy that, it is an interesting argument that he could because of all the hype, right?
Yeah.
He still hasn't won a playoff game.
Well, and there's a lot of guys. Yesterday we were talking about how you never have really bought into the Packers yet this season, and Dub hadn't bought into the Seahawks. You, on the same level, have not really bought in 100% on Lamar Jackson.
I don't buy into him long range.
Right,
a lot
of people
don't.
I mean,
if you told me right now, of the young quarterbacks, and the young quarterbacks right now would be Jimmy, I mean, roughly young, right? I mean, depending on how you want to define them.
Yep.
Jimmy Garoppolo is getting a little bit older. Deshaun Watson, young. Certainly Patrick Mahomes young and Lamar Jackson is young, right?
Well, and our boy Cowherd, he stirred the pot yesterday because he argued that the Ravens are going to be the next big Patriots type dynasty.
Yeah,
in the
I don't
NFL.
Buy that at all.
And a lot of people pushed back on our FoxSportsRadio.com website. There's tons of comments from listeners saying 3 years, maybe 5 years, he's going to get hurt. That style that Lamar Jackson plays, there's no way this is going to be some 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year run.
I think that's crazy.
So, and because of what happened against the Chargers and how he got shut down last season, even though he's the MVP all of a sudden this season, if he gets shut down again, then you and other people are going to say, see, same thing as what happened in the playoffs last season.
Yeah. I mean, I think until you win playoff games, that's what everybody's going to say. Everybody's going to criticize you and say whether or not you can win. So I think you could make an argument pretty strong that the guy with the most to gain is Kirk Cousins and the guy with the most to lose is Lamar Jackson. Now, the pushback I would say is Lamar Jackson's still only 23. So it's not as if he will, you know, fail to be in these situations again. But the pressure does get ratcheted up a lot when you haven't won a playoff game. And I think Deshaun Watson narrowly avoided that, for instance, because if Deshaun Watson loses at home back-to-back years, then that little voice out there of, you know, sort of the proverbial monkey on the back or whatever, that you can't win the big game, gets out there. We heard it with Peyton Manning forever, right? I mean, that whisper of, oh, we can't win the big game. It took him a long time to win that first Super Bowl. And so the pressure does get ratcheted up if you aren't able to win playoff games early on. And look, winning playoff games is hard. I think we underrate how hard it is to win a playoff game because of a guy like Brady or even a guy like Manning that are constantly there and put themselves in position to win a ton of games. A lot of guys out there. I mean, we just saw Ryan Tannehill had never won a playoff game. Kirk Cousins had never won a playoff game. And Deshaun Watson had never won a playoff game just in the first round of the wild card last week. So, yeah, that's a strong argument. The most to gain and the most to lose. Most to gain, Kirk Cousins. Most to lose, Lamar Jackson. I can buy that. What about you, Dub?
Yeah, I agree with the Kirk Cousins. I think there's another guy, though, Ryan Tannehill. If he were somehow to make this run and win a Super Bowl, the most to gain, just in the sense of a financial mind.
I think he's going to make a decent amount of money. My thing on Tannehill is I feel like he's answered a lot of – like the expectations were so much lower for Tannehill than they were for Kirk Cousins, right? I mean, Tannehill is making $7 or $8 million. He's kind of cast aside by the Dolphins. There's no doubt, by the way, that would be one of the most incredible stories ever if Tannehill got hot and won two more games and he rolled back down into Miami for the Super Bowl this year, where the Dolphins had cut him and kicked him to the curb, and he was playing in the Dolphins stadium to try to win a Super Bowl after all the difficulty the Dolphins have had trying to replace Dan Marino, and here's their former first-round pick in the Super Bowl. That would be an incredible story. So that's a good point, too.
Yeah, no doubt. And, looking at who would have the most to lose, it's a hard question to answer because, like you said, so many of these guys are so young, and you assume they're going to be back here in this moment. I think the guy with the most to lose right now is probably Aaron Rodgers because we don't really know how many more years he's going to have left or how many years he wants to keep playing. And he has this Packers team at 13-3. They have a home game against Seattle. If Seattle goes on the road and beats Green Bay after the year the Packers have had winning all these close games and getting this home game off of a bye, playing a Seattle team that's coming off a physical game on the road, I think that would be a big hit to Aaron Rodgers, even though I know he's already won a Super Bowl and he's a made man. But you keep looking ahead and how many more times is he going to be in the situation with a 13-3 team playing home games at Lambeau Field? I think that would be a big-time loss for Aaron Rodgers.
It is interesting, too, by the way. There's probably some people out there noticing this. This is how we define quarterbacks. There are, 53 men on every one of these rosters, but most of us see the NFL season through the prism very often of the quarterback, and we judge the team through the prism of the quarterback in a way that nobody sits around and says, what about Aaron Jones? Is he going to prove, as a running back that he can get it done in the postseason? Nobody's sitting around asking that question. nobody sitting around saying, you know, Mark Ingram better play in this game for the Ravens, or else there's going to be lots of questions about how well he does in the postseason because of what happened with him when he was with the Saints. Right? Everybody gives way too much credit to the quarterback and way too much blame, too. But this is kind of the prism through which we see it. How would you analyze this situation, Eddie?
Well, I will have to agree with just about everyone. I put most to gain Kirk Cousins, just as far as reputation, a guy who we constantly hear can't win the big one. If he were to have a deep run, get his team in the Super Bowl, that would obviously go a long way for him. But I agree with Dub financially. I think I would go with Ryan Tannehill. And the most to lose, I think it's Lamar Jackson. If he falls on his face in the playoffs, he's still going to win the MVP, but for most people, it'll be for nothing.
Yeah, and it is amazing to think about if Kirk Cousins was to win the Super Bowl, how much the talk about Kirk Cousins would just flip overnight. I think even if he got to the Super Bowl, I think you'd be hard-pressed to argue, oh, Kirk Cousins can't win the big game, right? Because at that point, as the sixth seed in the NFC, he would have gone on the road and he would have had to beat the Saints. Then he would have had to beat the 49ers. Then he would have had to go on the road and either beat the Seahawks. The Seahawks in Seattle. Or he would have had to beat Green Bay and Lambeau in order just to get to the Super Bowl. But my God, if he won the Super Bowl with that as his three games to win, then plus whoever he'd have to beat in the AFC down in Miami, it would be wild to see in terms of what the reaction would be. Roberto, most to gain, most to lose.
Most to gain, Kirk Cousins, for the reasons everybody mentioned already, and most to lose, Lamar Jackson, because who knows? I'm like you, Clay. I'm not a believer in that he's going to play like this forever. I think once Greg Roman is gone, I don't think he's going to be as effective anymore. But it seems like Greg Roman will be there at least another year or so.
Unless the Browns hire him, it doesn't seem like Greg Roman is going to get a head coaching job, which is crazy if you just look at overall achievement. Greg Roman has had one of the all-time great seasons as an offensive coordinator. It's wild to me that nobody in the NFL thought, hey, maybe this guy could do for one of our quarterbacks what he has done. Because he's been really good, not just with Lamar Jackson. He was really good with Tyrod Taylor when he was at Buffalo. And he was extraordinary with Colin Kaepernick when he was in San Francisco. So it appears that the Ravens are going to be able to keep Greg Roman. I don't know anything about the guy. I don't know what kind of interviewer he is. I don't know. I mean, he's kept a relatively low profile. But it is surprising to me that given how good of a season the Ravens have had, which we have put almost all the credit for their offense with him, that he wouldn't have gotten a head coaching job is wild. Even that he wouldn't get looked at in college. I mean, I would think there would be some colleges that would say, man, look at how advanced his system has been for the NFL. Maybe he could put something together that makes sense in college as well. By the way, that Mississippi State coaching job, we're going to talk about this later in the show, but they interviewed Mike Leach. Can you imagine the state of Mississippi with Lane Kiffin as the head coach of Ole Miss and as the head coach of Mississippi State, Mike Leach?
Holy.
I mean, you talk about just a pure on entertainment. That would be off the charts. I'm rooting for it just for that reason, if nothing else. All right, when we come back, we got all four of these NFL games that are going on Saturday and Sunday. How do you bet them? We got Harry Gagnon from the Against All Odds podcast as well as, no, Frank Isola. Man, I thought it was Wednesday. I thought it was Wednesday today. Oh, I said we're 2 days away. I'm sitting here thinking, wait a minute. And then as I said it, I was like, I feel like we just talked to Harry. Am I having him on 2 days in a row?
You know what? Wednesday's show did go really well, but you don't need to live in the past.
I know. It did go so smooth. All right. Frank Isola is going to join us. There's some stupid. Did you guys see this stupid story about, I guess, John Beilein used the word thugs?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, is this real? I mean, I just saw the headline this morning when I woke up.
He says he meant to say slugs.
But is it that offensive to say you played like a bunch of thugs, like that it's like, oh, my God, it's the number one story on ESPN?
It really wouldn't make sense. If he said something like that, I'd be like, what? Like, you know, did somebody elbow somebody in the mouth and break teeth? Like, just the mix-up is confusing. It doesn't make sense.
We'll talk to Frank Isola about this. Some of the NBA drama stories, like, there are so many athletes that are perpetually, it seems like they're triggered. I mean, when did everybody become such a bunch of pussy willows? When we come back, we'll talk with Frank Isola about that.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Frank Isola at the Frank Isola on Twitter. You can watch him on Around the Horn, sometimes PTI as well. And you can read him at The Athletic, listen to him Sirius XM as well as here. Frank, sometimes I see stories that are headlines and I'm like, I can't believe that this is actually a sports headline. And such is the case right now. When I woke up this morning, Adrian Wojnarowski reporting that John Beilein used the word thugs, and somehow that's incredibly offensive during a film session. Am I crazy, or does the vast majority of America, you think, agree with me that this is not actually a number one sports story in America?
Yeah, I think things have gotten a little crazy. I do think you have to be a little careful with the things that you say. I think especially for a guy like John Beilein, look at the position he's in to begin with. He's an older guy coming from college, you know, and I think we've already seen stories, which I think have been unfair, about, you know, the players basically saying, oh, you know, he's doing things in a college way and he wants us to be more of a development team. But yeah, sure. Like, what have you guys, you guys have been terrible for the last, like, couple of years, ever since LeBron left. But I think it's something like that. And it's funny you mention that, because I had heard from somebody yesterday that this is going to be it for John Beilein. He's going to be kind of like a one and done kind of guy.
And go back to college. Like,
yeah, well, perhaps. I mean, he's going to have a lot of money coming to him from, but then, not that it's going to be his choice. I think Cleveland's going to get rid of him, and then he's still going to get paid his money. And I think something like this will only accelerate the process.
Does this make him just think, oh, why in the world did I ever leave college?
It's you know, it's funny you say that. The other day, Michigan played Michigan State, and it was like on a night where Cleveland got killed by somebody. And I kept thinking, he must have, like, saw that game. Not that it's easy to play Michigan State in East Lansing, but he must have thought to himself, you know, life was just so much easier back then. But you know what happens? I'm sure for a lot of these guys, you reach a certain age, and, you know, here's an opportunity to coach in the NBA. There's only 30 of those jobs. And you think to yourself, you know, if I'm ever going to do it, now's the time to do it. The money is going to be pretty good. It's, you know, it's a tough hire. It's unfortunate, because you're in a tough position as a college coach, number one. And I think as an older guy, I think you're in a much more difficult position. Brad Stevens walked into a good situation because he's a little bit younger, and the Boston Celtics are a more stable franchise. And at the time when Brad Stevens came there, they were also a bad team, and they didn't have a player like Kevin Love. Let's be fair. Kevin Love is one of the guys causing some issues with that team too. His, like, the way his antics, kind of lashing out at people, and he's been fined, lashing out on the bench, yelling at the general manager. So, like, the one veteran player on the team that, you know, you would want and hope could kind of, like, be the leader of the team, that hasn't happened to John Beilein.
There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen in the offseason. That's the NBA story that's out there, so I'm going to leave it. Let's go back to the NFL. What do you think happens with Brady? Do you think that he comes back for another year or two with the Patriots, or do you think this turns into another power struggle? Belichick maybe ends up winning, because I think this could turn into, okay, the Patriots are willing to let Brady come back for a year, but they won't give him a multi-year deal. And I think Brady probably thinks to himself, I want at least a two-year deal going forward. And so that could be the linchpin that leads him to consider other options out there in the NFL. How do you see this playing out?
I think you nailed it. I think it's them wanting him maybe for 1 year and him wanting a two-year deal. And, you know, let's not forget that this weekend the San Francisco 49ers are going to be playing in a playoff game, and the quarterback there is Jimmy Garoppolo. And if you look at Bill Belichick, the way that he's done business all throughout this incredible run that the Patriots have been on, he's kind of gotten rid of the guy just when he thinks things are about to turn. And listen, Brady won the Super Bowl last year. Could they have done that maybe with Jimmy Garoppolo? Perhaps, but it's, you can't tell me that Bill Belichick is not going to sit there this weekend and thinking, this guy should be our quarterback right now. And Jimmy Garoppolo should not be the quarterback of the 49ers. We had him in our system. We're the team that developed him. And, you know, and I'm still convinced that Bill Belichick didn't want to get rid of him. I think maybe Brady felt a little threatened. He and Robert Kraft are pretty tight. I think they live on the same street. So I think that whole situation, it's just different. The way they're dealing with Brady, who is a unique case. Number one, he's the quarterback. Number two, he's a legendary player who's been there for all the Super Bowls, and he's been the leader of the team. But it just goes against everything that Bill Belichick has always done. He's always gotten rid of the guy.
You're exactly
maybe
right.
1 year too early, as opposed to 1 year too late. Whether it was Richard Seymour, you know, we can go down the list of guys, and it's always been a doubtful.
And it's always been sort of an emotionless move by Belichick,
yes.
Right? Like, I mean, that ultimately he is. And I think that's hard when you go to war with these guys to then be able to just cut bait, because you're ultimately just it's business for Belichick. You're only as good as the dollar value next to your name. Do your job is kind of the mantra that they have in New England. And I 100% agree with you. There's no way that Belichick wants to be paying big money to Tom Brady when he thinks he's on the back end of his career. I think Belichick's got to be ready to turn the page. And I think, by the way, both of these guys want to prove that they were the reason why this dynasty came to be. I think there's a power struggle there. Who was the bigger reason for the success? Was it Brady or was it Belichick? I think both of them want to be the guy, and that means they want to win a Super Bowl without the other. I think there's an element of that. That's why Belichick's now saying, hey, I'll coach into my 70s, and also why I think Brady might possibly be interested in exploring some of the other teams out there, because if he could win another Super Bowl without the Patriots, then he has an argument of, I'm the reason why we won at such a high level.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at the way things went down the last couple of weeks with them, you know, Brady did drive them down the field and put them ahead against Miami. So, you know, Bill Belichick's bread and butter and the Patriots' bread and butter this year has been their defense. So if the defense can get one stop, you know, they're getting a bye week, and then they're getting a home playoff game. So they got to win one home playoff game, and then they're in the AFC Championship game. The defense failed. Then last week, you know, the Edelman drop, that was big. I mean, Brady clearly wasn't himself. And I just thought the whole thing was weird. Like, when they didn't go for it on fourth down, the punter punts it into the end zone, and then once again it's up to the defense to make a stop. They eventually did stop Tennessee, but then they ended up getting the ball back with 15 seconds. So I don't think Brady was as bad as everyone says. I think he's hurt. I think when you're Mr. TB12, and this is kind of how you market yourself, I don't think that he wanted to come out and tell people that his elbow's hurting him, because that's kind of like maybe bad for business. His TB12, the TB12 method and all that other nonsense. I also think, let's face it too, the season began and everyone thought, yeah, missing Gronkowski will be big, but then they added Antonio Brown and people are like, oh, maybe they'll go undefeated. Look how great this offense is. They weren't great at the skill positions either. And Edelman, like, as everyone says, is a slot receiver that they were trying to turn in, you know, to the next Jerry Rice, and it wasn't going to work out that way. So I think injuries for Brady, I don't think his elbow was right. And I just think, you know, basically talent is what eventually was their, you know, undoing.
We just had to open the show looking at the 8 quarterbacks that are left, who has the most to gain and who has the most to lose. Most to gain, we said Kirk Cousins, because if he suddenly won a Super Bowl and beat in the process the Saints, the 49ers, and either the Seahawks or the Packers to get to the Super Bowl, plus whoever he'd have to beat in the AFC, it would change every belief about Kirk Cousins. We said the most to lose, Lamar Jackson, because he still hasn't won a playoff game. Last year's playoffs didn't go very well. Granted, he's going to be the MVP. He had a great regular season. But everybody who doubts whether or not his range and style of football is sustainable would have a lot of ammunition if he were to lose again in the first round of the playoffs. You buy into those, or do you see it as a different analysis?
Well, I also think, you know, I'd put Aaron Rodgers up there just because you think he's running out of chances here to get back to a Super Bowl. And, you know, they're in a position now where one home playoff win, they're in the NFC title game. They could conceivably be the team that hosts the NFC title game. But I do agree with Lamar Jackson, because, you know, he was not good last year losing to the Chargers. I thought at the time that they should have taken him out in the second half to give themselves a chance. I give John Harbaugh credit, because I think he figured, you know what, this guy's going to be my quarterback, so
yes,
I'm not going to mess with him right now. And to Harbaugh's credit and Lamar Jackson's credit, you know, they bounced back pretty well from what was an ugly, you know, the numbers that he had and the score looked good, but Lamar Jackson was terrible last year in that first playoff game. He couldn't do anything. So I do think that he has a lot to lose. Plus, you know, they have the one team, no offense to Tennessee Titans, you know, they have the team that everybody thinks that they should win the game. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on him. Kirk Cousins finally got his first win out of the way. We'll see if Jimmy Garoppolo could do that. But the big one will be Lamar Jackson. The guy's gone from never winning a playoff game to now being the favorite. So can he win 3 playoff games and lift the trophy? And he's going to get 2 of those games at home. But we'll see how he does, because the playoffs, it's always a different animal in the playoffs. And you know, if you fall behind and now you're kind of relying more on his arm than you are on his legs, we'll see how that works out. But who knows? Maybe he doesn't even trail at all during the playoffs.
We're talking to Frank Isola at the Frank Isola on Twitter. You can find him there. You can watch him on Around the Horn, listen to him on SiriusXM, read him at The Athletic. What are you hearing about Eli? There's a lot of talk about the offseason free agents. We talked about Brady and what he's going to decide to do. Cam Newton, obviously. You got Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota, Phillip Rivers, Teddy Bridgewater. I mean, there are going to be a lot of different moving parts for quarterbacks. What are you hearing about Eli? Is he officially going to retire? Is he going to test the market to see if anybody's interested in him? What happens?
I'm sure the Giants, that's what they want, and they want it to be a nice, like, little clean, you know, break like that where he would retire. It sounds like he still wants to play a little bit, which, you know, I find surprising. You know, the one thing about Brady, I still think that Brady could play. Drew Brees, I think, could play. Phillip Rivers, I don't understand why he throws the ball like that. It's, like, painful to watch.
Yeah, right.
Ball. I'm not so sure about him. I just don't know if Eli has it. Like, can Eli be a starting quarterback on a team? I'm not so sure. To me, he's been kind of declining for a bunch of years now. You know, he had his one moment. He got to play one last time at MetLife, and he won the game. The word was, too, like, he's not that crazy about being a backup quarterback. I think if he was open to being a backup, he'll be in the league. But it sounds like, and I understand it, that he wants to start, but I don't know. I just don't see it. Unless there are things that are happening over the summer where, you know, guys are getting hurt and things like that. But I think what the Giants want is for Eli Manning to either come back and be the backup to Daniel Jones, or just announce that he's retiring and have like a nice like little clean break and let him go out as a two-time Super Bowl champion.
Last question for you. I know it's the new year. I don't think we had you on last week, but you've been covering New York area sports and beyond for a long time, but was the 2010s the worst decade of New York sports of your life in terms of being relevant on a big stage for football and for basketball and for big sports in general?
I think someone said that. I mean, think about it, Clay. We got two teams in New York. I'm pretty sure someone said there were two playoff games played at MetLife, and one of them was the Super Bowl between the Broncos and the 49ers.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the Broncos and the Seahawks.
Yeah.
So think about that. And then, you know, and I think the big one would be, you know, it was the first decade that the Yankees didn't, you know, make it to a World Series or win a World Series. So that is kind of the measuring stick, because the Yankees are always, like, held in a different category just because all the winning that they've done. You know, the Knicks were the Knicks in this decade. Actually, probably was the worst decade ever for the Knicks, even though they did win a playoff series. But they're right now on a stretch of five straight seasons of at least 50 losses twice. I think they lost 60 games. I think that would be pretty fair. And the pathetic thing about it is, I've said this to you before, we have two of everything.
Yeah.
And we have technically three hockey teams. I guess the Rangers made the Stanley Cup. The Mets did make a World Series. And the Giants, one of their Super Bowls came in this decade, right, against the Patriots. That had to be right?
Yeah, I think that's
right.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So, but I think it's kind of judged by baseball, especially, and the Yankees having kind of the decade that, even though they were good, but the Yankees are kind of like, you know, like Tom Brady or LeBron James are basically judged on whether or not they made it to a finals and won a championship, not if they made, you know, game seven of the, you know, of the American League Championship Series.
Outstanding stuff as always. He's Frank Isola at the Frank Isola on Twitter. You can watch him on ESPN Around the Horn, read him at The Athletic, and listen to him at SiriusXM. Thanks, my man.
Thanks, Clay.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Appreciate all of you hanging out with us as we inch closer to the divisional round of the NFL playoffs. Can't wait to see what's going to happen with both games on Saturday and on Sunday. If you're just waking up with us, encourage you to go download the podcast. We had a big debate about who had the most to win and the most to lose among the eight quarterbacks still alive. Most to win, we agreed, Kirk Cousins. The most to lose, Lamar Jackson, as we come down the stretch run here of the NFL season. Sadly, only seven games remain in the NFL year. Four Saturday and Sunday combined, to the next weekend, and then the Super Bowl, which will be taking place down in Miami. By the way, we will be doing this show live in Miami for a week. I don't know. Danny G, you may know more details about exactly how that's set up. Do we know if the venue is public in any way? This is always a question we ask, whether you can walk through When we're on early in the morning, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, sometimes they open it up. If you're going to be in the Miami area or if you're down in South Florida, there are a lot of really cool free events usually that surround the Super Bowl. They do a good job, the NFL does, of putting on events around there. And one of the things you can do that I think is pretty cool and I would have wanted to do if I were a kid or certainly if I were a teenager and I was there with my parents is walk through Radio Row and just see kind of the setup where everybody is broadcasting and there's lots of athletes and famous people walking around doing the rounds on Radio Row. That's usually open a part of the day, but whether it's going to be open the 3 hours that we're there or not, I'm not sure. But we will be there live the entire week. Also, lock it in, which is going to be really fun. Fox is building, my understanding is, a huge television set on South Beach, which I believe will be visible and accessible to the public. In other words, like we're literally on the sand in South Beach because Fox has this year's Super Bowl, and we will have Lock It In every day for an hour, our television show, which is at 4:30 Eastern, 3:30 Central, 2:30 Mountain, 1:30 Pacific, and we'll have a live audience, I think, and we'll be right there on the beach. So that's going to be pretty wild. Nice. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm told that the set that they have built for the Super Bowl is going to be incredible. It's really kind of wild how they build this entire venue from scratch, and then they'll take it down right afterwards. But it looks like a legitimate big time venue. They did it. The last couple of I've been to two Super Bowls that Fox has had. The first one was in New York City, and they had an awesome Times Square venue where they had, when they did the New York City Super Bowl, and then they did one in Houston, and so this will be the third one that I've been a part of, and those are always even more of zoos, but this will be the first time that I've been with Fox where we've been on television, so every day, so this will be fun with Lock It In, with the gambling show, and everything else, so that is all still on the horizon. We'll be finishing the NFL season with a real bang for Outkick, both radio and TV. But there are a couple of crazy stories out there that I saw and I thought to myself, oh my God, this would be incredible. One is Mississippi State is considering who they're going to hire as their next head football coach. Now, the two names that I'm hearing the most are Steve Sarkisian, who is the offensive coordinator for Alabama, formerly the USC and Washington head coach, who had to lose his job at USC over alcohol-related issues, seems to have managed to cleanse himself. He was also then the offensive coordinator for the Atlanta Falcons, that maybe he could get back into coaching at Mississippi State. The other one is current Washington State head coach Mike Leach, who reports are interviewed for this Mississippi State job. So can you imagine how much fun, purely from a football and off the field related perspective as well, having both Lane Kiffin as the head coach of Ole Miss and Mike Leach as the head coach of Mississippi State could be both in the state of Mississippi, both in the SEC. That would be must-see television every single day with what would be going on between the two of them. And honestly, I think Mississippi State felt a lot of pressure to move on from Joe Moorhead because Lane Kiffin was soaking up so much of the oxygen in the state of Mississippi and getting so much attention that if they decide to go with, and I think they may well do it, if they decide to make the decision to hire Mike Leach, I think it's a response in many ways to all of the attention that's come to bear for Lane Kiffin. And my God, that would be incredibly entertaining. Starkville would also somehow fit with Mike Leach, who has been prior to that at Texas Tech, which is kind of off the radar, at Washington State, which is certainly off the radar, and Mississippi State, Starkville, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but it would be the most fertile recruiting region that Mike Leach had ever been in. And I've always been curious, how would Mike Leach be able to do if he ever got a job that was actually really good? We had him on the Wins and Losses podcast, and what he made a distinction was, he said, I've only been at schools where you recruit. I've never been at a school where you get to give out invitations. And that was a good way of putting it. He said there's two different types of schools. There's the schools that recruit, hey, please come here, we think you'll be a good fit. And there's the schools that send out invitations. And he said, I've never really been at a school that sends out invitations. I think he was at Oklahoma for 1 year as offensive coordinator, if I'm not mistaken. But by and large, he's mostly been at the schools with chips on their shoulder, the ones that are a little bit outside of the mainstream. So that would be an incredible story if he were to come to Mississippi and join Lane Kiffin in that state. Another crazy story, and I want to bring in the crew. I don't even know if you guys saw this story because it just came out last night, and I couldn't. I'm just going to read you a paragraph from Mark Schlabaugh's story. Mark Schlabaugh is a reporter at ESPN.com. But there is a so Georgia, we said in the end of last hour, Jake Fromm is going to go going pro, and Georgia has had a lot of players that have basically decided they're going to leave early or they're in the transfer portal. Kirby Smart has been recruiting incredibly well, but it seems clear that there is a lot of drama associated with the Georgia football program right now. And sometimes that comes when you recruit a lot of really high-level talent. That talent expects to be coddled when it gets to campus, and if things don't go perfectly, they might decide to leave. And for instance, you can use as a quarterback situation right there at Georgia, an example. They have signed Jacob Eason, Jake Fromm, and Justin Fields, all big-time quarterback talents in three different years, right? Boom, boom, boom. And so you had Jacob Eason lose his job to Jake Fromm, and so he transfers to Washington. He's now in the draft. Jake Fromm is in the draft, and you had Justin Fields unhappy about the amount of playing time he was getting and the fact that he couldn't win the job from Jake Fromm. He wasn't willing to wait. And so even though he's a Georgia native, he decides to transfer to Ohio State. So all three of those guys are now gone from Georgia, and Georgia kind of is scrambling to figure out who their next quarterback is going to be. They may have to go get somebody out of the transfer portal. But one of Georgia's top recruits, and they've got a lot of top recruits, but they had a five-star left tackle by the name of Cade Mays. Now, Cade Mays has a dad who played at the University of Tennessee on the offensive line, and he also has a younger brother who just committed to the University of Tennessee as well. So Cade Mays has officially left Georgia. He was their starting left tackle in the Sugar Bowl. He has officially left Georgia, and his dad is now suing the University of Georgia. This is all 100% of a real story, all right? And I'm going to read this to you guys, and I don't even know if anybody else on the show has heard anything about this. Danny G, if you know anything about Cade Mays or Georgia.
I saw this story okay, you early saw me this tweeting. Morning. Yes.
All right, so here is, I'm reading directly from an ESPN.com story. According to Athens-Clarke County State Court records, Mays's parents sued the University of Georgia System Board of Regents, the Georgia Athletic Association, and others after Kevin Mays's, all right, get ready, right pinky finger was amputated because an accident involving a folding chair at the Bulldogs team gala in December of 2017. The son was then a senior on a recruiting visit to Georgia. According to the complaint for damages filed on December 5th of 2019, are you ready? Are you ready for this? Plaintiff Kevin Mays, that's the dad, right pinky finger was partially amputated as the subject folding chair, oh, this is making me cringe just reading it, wedged against a column, his severed finger shot across the floor.
Oh.
Georgia offensive line coach Sam Pittman, who is now the head coach at Arkansas, picked up his severed finger from the floor, and it was put on ice. You might be thinking to yourself, oh, my God, can SEC football get any stranger? Yes, this lawsuit is being used as evidence for why Cade Mays, this five-star, should be eligible to play this coming fall at Tennessee because his dad is suing the school over his finger getting amputated. I mean, and I want to bring it. So you saw, like, Danny G, you saw this. Dub, yeah. Did you know this story? Eddie Garcia, did you know this story? Roberto, had you guys heard this?
I knew this story because one of the two other people I live with, he is a Georgia alum, and he was not too happy.
They're
about
furious.
This. They are absolutely furious. He was, you know, saying some things that are not appropriate for terrestrial radio right now, but he was hot and bothered about it. I mean, he was up in arms.
And like, Eddie, when you hear this story as a Californian, that a severed finger is being used as evidence of why a player should be. I mean, I by the way, I just cringe thinking about your finger getting caught and getting clipped, getting amputated, and then the guy, the offensive line coach, picks it up on the ground. I mean, is this as crazy of a story to you as it is to me?
Yeah, rub some dirt on it and get back in there.
But so the wild thing is here, the expectation is that the son is going to be eligible to play. And this rubs people the wrong way at Georgia, not just because this is a crazy story, but because there's still a lot of anger over the way Justin Fields left Georgia and was immediately eligible to play at Ohio State. And I'm surprised this didn't get more attention. Do you guys remember the background for how usually, so if you're not a hardcore college football or college basketball fan, the general rule is, if you transfer, you have to sit out a year before you can play for the new school that you transfer to. But there are certain limited exceptions. The most common exception is if you graduate from your original school early, then you can transfer anywhere and be eligible to play. And this happens a lot with quarterbacks. This is, for instance, how Jalen Hurts was able to play without having to sit out going from Alabama to Oklahoma. This is how Joe Burrow was able to play going from Ohio State to LSU. If you graduate, that's a pretty understood exemption that you're able to then come in and play immediately at your new school. The graduate, so-called graduate transfer exemption. That's well established. That isn't that controversial. I think it's a rule that makes a lot of sense. The general rule, however, if you are an underclassman, is that you have to sit out for a year. But if you can show extenuating circumstances, i.e. conflict or major issues, sometimes it can be as simple as, and it's not simple, it's unfortunate, but if you have, for instance, an ill parent, if you have gone away from school a long way away, and then one of your parents becomes very sick, you can use that as a hardship. In order to be closer back to home, you can be able to transfer, and a lot of times that's allowed and not fought, right? But in this scenario, what the hardship would be is that there's a lawsuit being filed between the dad and the university, and as a result, the kid doesn't feel comfortable because his dad is suing the university for a lot of money, and so he should be eligible to play. But the one, and they never really explained, the NCAA didn't, what the full reason for the waiver was, but Justin Fields left Georgia, did not have to sit out at all, and immediately started playing for Ohio State, and at least the public story for why he got a hardship waiver was, somebody in the crowd who was a baseball player at Georgia made a racial slur, and so he then didn't have to sit out for a year. And a lot of people at Georgia are fired up about that, not because they're trying to defend the guy for what he said, but because Justin Fields' sister, is my understanding, is still playing softball at Georgia. So can you really argue that the standard for a hardship waiver should be one person in a crowd of 100,000 said a racial slur, and so you get to use that as an excuse to then be eligible to play without having to sit out at all at Ohio State? A lot of people at Georgia were mad about that because they felt like, oh, that's just Justin Fields playing the game, trying to use that to his advantage so that he doesn't have to sit out for a year and he gets to play immediately for Ohio State. And now they're similarly angry about this lawsuit that has been filed over the amputated finger that theoretically could lead to this five-star offensive lineman not only transferring, but transferring in conference, and not only transferring in conference, but transferring in division and being eligible to play, all because his dad's finger got chopped off and he's now suing Georgia over it.
At a recruiting dinner. So that means there was food on the table.
I find the idea of getting a finger amputated to be really difficult to handle to begin with.
Is there pictures of this?
I'm sure there is in a lawsuit.
Oh.
So what do you think? Like, I mean, so the argument is that this lawsuit is convenient. However, I will say this. I wouldn't get my finger chopped off in order for my kid to be able to not have to sit out for a year at school.
What kind of father are you?
Yeah, I don't know where I would draw the line, but I'm drawing the line at fingers getting chopped off. So welcome to SEC football, where you can't even make up some of these stories. That you would have a five-star. This guy is expected to be a first-round draft pick. I mean, that's how talented he is on the offensive line. Where exactly on the offensive line he ends up playing in the NFL, that's still to be determined. He might be a tackle. He might be a guard. But he's a big-time talent. Five-star recruit. Was starting for Georgia at left tackle in the Sugar Bowl less than a month ago. And now is enrolled at the University of Tennessee and taking classes today as we speak, because classes have now started at the University of Tennessee, and his expectation is that he'll be able to play and start come September because his dad got his finger amputated and is now suing the University of Georgia.
So what does his dad's finger have to do with his hardship?
I think the argument is that when you are in a lawsuit suing, when your family is suing the university, that you are worried about your treatment. And so that is considered to be one of the criteria for potentially a hardship to be granted. And I'm not an expert on hardship waivers when it comes to NCAA transfer status. But the attorney for Cade Mays' dad has said they've already filed, I think, a hardship waiver with the NCAA, has said effectively this clearly fits the criteria for what would have to happen in order for somebody to be eligible.
All right, then.
I mean, they have a lawyer and attorney. This is the attorney talking. Said, I'm very confident Cade won't have to sit out a year. He's representing Cade Mays. He says that. Let's see. What does he say? Anyway, basically that he believes that this is going to allow Cade Mays among, and there may be other factors, right? I mean, I don't claim to understand everything associated with the hardship. And I do know that Justin Fields is a legal team that got him eligible to play at Ohio State. They would say, well, it wasn't just about that racial slur. There were other hardships involved. I have no idea what those were. Again, because to my understanding, those hardship applications are not public for everyone. But it is, I think, indicative of the fact that systems can be gamed sometimes in these scenarios. All right, when we come back, we are scheduled to be joined by Chris Mannix. We'll break down the latest NBA controversy. Also, there's been a lot of debate, and I do think this is an interesting question. Is Luka Doncic the best 20-year-old basketball player since LeBron, maybe Magic Johnson? Is he the best ever? How good is Luka, and how important is that to the NBA, plus the latest stupid controversy in the NBA?
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com and within the iHeartRadio app.
We're joined now by Chris Mannix. He writes at SI. You can read him there. So let's start here. Luka lost a tough game last night to Jokic, but there's been a lot of debate of late. You are an expert in this realm. Where does Luka rank among the best 20-year-olds that we have seen in the last 25 or 30 years of NBA action? There seems to be kind of a consensus that he's up there with LeBron James and Magic Johnson as maybe one of the best three we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years. Fair or foul to make that comparison?
Oh, I think that's very fair. You know, I'd have to go back and look at how good Magic was at 20 years old in the NBA. But I remember LeBron at 20, and he was great. So I think LeBron is really his only peer. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the high school guys that came in the mid-1990s, whether it was Kobe or Kevin Garnett, there was a reasonably steep learning curve for those guys. I mean, Kobe, look at his numbers then. He wasn't great early on. He wasn't anywhere near what Luka is early on. So The speed with which Luka Doncic has risen to this level is remarkable. And look, a lot of it is attributable to the fact that he was playing pro ball at 14,
you know,
and he was he was the MVP of the EuroLeague at 18. So, when you get to play pro early on and go up against men early on, it makes it so much easier to adjust.
So, what is his ceiling? I mean, so this is, I think, a big deal for the NBA. And again, I do think it's not ideal in that it would be better. Like, I think we talked the last time we talked. I said, man, can you imagine how much different Giannis would be received if instead of being Greek, he had been born in America? And I feel the same thing if instead of being named Luka, if he was named Luke, right, and he was from, somewhere in the middle part of the country, like Larry Bird was, that would be a bigger and better connection, because still, even in this era where everything is globalized, I think American sports fans react better to American sports heroes. So, but having said that, how big is he potentially for the NBA in general, given how talented he is at such a young age?
Yeah, I think, look, I really think that Luka has the chance to be the face of the NBA over the next 5 or 10 years, however long it takes for LeBron to be done. I mean, it seems a little bit different. I mean, we did have that conversation about Giannis and, his, not inability to truly connect with NBA fans, but it's not as strong as maybe it should be. I think Luka's a little bit different, though. Maybe it's the position he plays and the style with which he plays, but he's flashy. He's, kind of a 6'7" point guard in the same way that Magic Johnson was. I think because he's just more of a perimeter ball handling type of guy, he might be a little bit easier to connect to for NBA fans. So, I mean, there's a handful of guys that you could see being the heir apparent to LeBron, but because Luke is so good this age and because he's able to do what he can do right now, I mean, I think he's the kind of the top of the list of the next guy.
All right, so if you're comparing him to LeBron, and that's obviously an insanely favorable comparison to anybody, right, at the age of 20, LeBron has continued to get better and better as he's aged, and I know now he's 35 years old or whatever the heck he is, and he's still incredible, and he's had that sort of long plateau of excellence. A guy down in Dallas who did have a long plateau of excellence was Dirk Nowitzki as well. But one of the questions about Luka, I would say, is how much better can he get? You mentioned that he started playing with professionals when he's 14, 15 years old. Do you worry at all that he doesn't have the same kind of climb and mountain that he can climb like LeBron? In other words, he might already be closer to his plateau than certainly LeBron was at the age of 20.
Well, maybe, but I mean, I'd have to look at his numbers right now, but a couple of weeks ago he was within a couple of stats of averaging a triple-double. So
that's still a pretty high plateau. Yeah.
Yeah. If this is his plateau, I mean, all right. I mean, great. He's a consensus all-star, a top five MVP. I think there are a couple of ways that I think he's going to get better. One, you can't really teach athleticism, but I think he's going to, as he gets more and, adjusted the NBA game, I think he's going to be a little bit better in that regard.
Like, he was chunky last year, right? Like, he wasn't in great physical condition.
Well, this was the knock on him coming into the NBA that, he didn't have the body for playing NBA basketball. And, year two, he's got a significantly better body. And as we've seen with every NBA player that plays for a long time, year three, four, five, they get big. I mean, God, look at Giannis at year one, year two. He was a string bean. Now he's a tank out there on the floor. I don't think that Luka's going to be the exact same way, but I think he's just going to get better physically. I tell you, I was having this conversation, and I'm in Orlando this week working on a story with Markelle Fultz, and you look at the teams that passed on Luka. It is inexplicable, Clay, that Sacramento passed on Luka Doncic. You have one of the great all-time international players as GM in Vlade Divac. His assistant GM is Peja Stojakovic. They've got a European guy as their top scout. How do you pass on this guy? Like, how in the world do you miss on Luka Doncic to take Marvin Bagley? I don't. Bagley's fine, but how that front office missed on Luka is going to go down as one of the most incredible passes, I think, in recent NBA history.
Well, and this is a big part of Luka's story, right? Is that Mark Cuban passed on Giannis because he was like, I don't really buy into it. And he like his guys like beat the table this time and said, don't blow it again. Like, we think Luka can be another Giannis. And I think I'm correct. Those two guys are the leading vote getters in the NBA All-Star right now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. It, but it, like, even the Cuban stuff, like, you know, that was back in, what, 2013. And at that point, Cuban wanted the cap space to sign free agents. And you could see the argument. I mean, and look, a lot of people passed on Giannis back then. He was nowhere near the, like, the obvious choice that Luka was. I mean, it just, when you play over in Europe and you know, and you should know if you're Vlade, like, how good the EuroLeague is.
Right.
Like, the guy was the MVP of the EuroLeague. How do you pass on him? Like, I even get, like, DeAndre Ayton a little bit, so you take him number one overall. Like, you can see the obvious potential there, but there's no, like, it just blows my mind that Marvin Bagley was the choice over Doncic at Sacramento.
We're talking to Chris Mannix at SI Chris Mannix. All right, this is I didn't see this story. I woke up and it's a number one story right now. John Beilein saying that he used the word thugs to describe his players during a film session or something. Is this a 12-hour story? Is this a 24-hour story? I think a lot of people are kind of rolling their eyes over this being a story at all. But how significant is it in the NBA universe?
I think it's significant. I think it will blow over, but in the greater context, it's just kind of another log on the fire being built under John Beilein right now. I just, look, I don't think he's cut out to be an NBA coach. I mean, some
college guys...
Do you
think he wishes he had never left Michigan right now? Like,
you can go back. I mean, like, when you are, like, he's 66 years old, and in some ways, you know, this is like fantasy camp for him. He got to leave the cesspool that is college basketball, and he kind of alluded to it being as such, and take a chance at being an NBA coach. But from everything I hear from people around that team, he runs the practices and runs the day-to-day like it's still college. And you can't do that. You can't have, like, 3-4-hour days where you're doing long practices and long film sessions with NBA players. Maybe some of them you can do it with, but most of them you can't. And I had somebody just a couple of days ago, you know, compare his run as an NBA coach to what Mike Montgomery went through when he left Stanford to go coach the Warriors. He just wasn't cut out to be an NBA coach. And I'm starting to get the feeling that John Beilein, you know, may be the exact same way. I mean, I was working, Clay, in Boston when Rick Pitino came to the NBA, and Rick Pitino back then had, like, his own guys. He had basically had Kentucky 2.0. It was like Tony Delk and Walter McCarty and Antoine Walker. And he still failed because he just couldn't figure out a way to coach differently and run a team differently. And it feels like Beilein is just the same way. So this, that's a long way of saying that I think this current incident will pass, but it's just another reason why maybe the Cavaliers will part ways with Beilein after the season.
Because this was a big story that he had decided to leave Michigan and take over. I mean, a lot of people were stunned that he had made this decision. And the reason why I say, do you think he wishes when he watches Michigan play in Michigan State, let's say, that a part of him wishes, man, why in the world did I ever leave that for this? I mean, and I guess the larger context is, what is the biggest difference between coaching in college and the NBA? I'm sure there are tons, but is it just that there's a lot less X's and O's, especially during the regular season, a lot less coaching, so to speak? I mean, how would you assess it so far as you can tell, the difference between a coach making the leap to a different league?
I think that's part of it. The X's and O's. I remember when Calipari went pro, he was not a good X's and O's coach. I mean, there was one time I think he, you know, sent four guys out onto the floor at one point for a sequence. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that went on there in New Jersey. But I think more of it is, look, you can, you know, run guys into the wall over a 30-game season. You know, and you can say whatever you want to 18-year-olds. You can't do that to grown men who are making more money than you. And you can't do that over 82 games. It just doesn't work. And when you're, and from what I hear, there are like these long practices in Cleveland and long film sessions in Cleveland. Like, I just can't connect to that. There's got to be a middle ground, and I don't think Beilein has found. I still don't think he regrets it. I mean, the guy got a 5-year contract, like, to coach in the NBA, guaranteed. So he can, even if he gets let go, I mean, he can just walk away with his sort of, you know, proverbial Rolex watch for the next, you know, 4 years. And if he really does want to get back into college coaching, there's no doubt he'd be able to do it. But I don't understand it from a Cleveland perspective. I mean, there's so many good young coaches out there. I mean, his assistant coach, J.B. Bickerstaff, is a really good coach they could have hired to coach that team. So I just don't understand the thinking between, you know, hiring a guy like that to coach a rebuilding team.
What else should we be aware of as we come up on the midway point of the NBA season? Is the, you know, because I think there's a lot of people out there, certainly in my audience, who are all in on football, and they're going to watch the divisional round this weekend, and they're going to watch the NBA, the national title game for college football on Monday. And then they'll suddenly realize, oh, wait, you know, they got a couple of games left, only three games left in the regular NFL season, and they'll start to pivot to college and to the NBA. What would you say is out there that they should be really paying attention to as they come out of this football universe?
Well, look, when you get into February, it's going to be a lot of fun because I think there's going to be a lot of activity before the trade deadline. Not the monster players being moved, but the fringe guys that a lot of teams are going to be after, the Tristan Thompsons, the Robert Covingtons, guys that could make a difference as your sixth or seventh man, because there's more parity in the NBA right now than there's been, than really I can remember, at least in the 20 years that I've been covering the league. And look, you know, to talk about something that I'm working on right now, I think the Markelle Fultz story is the best story in the NBA. I mean, this guy went through hell in Philadelphia, you know, dealing with everything he dealt with physically, and I've seen two games of his this week. I mean, he kicked the crap out of Brooklyn with 25 points on Monday, and he had seven assists last night in a blowout win for Washington. I mean, this is Orlando doesn't get a lot of pub, and I get why, but you know, watching Markelle Fultz turn his career around down in Orlando and become, you know, have the beginnings of a high level point guard is really fun to watch. I mean, I honestly think he's the best story in the NBA. I really do. Just because of where he was and all the things he went through to where he is right now is really remarkable.
Last question for you. Zion comes back when?
I from what I hear, either the end of this month or early next month, and when he comes back, it will be very reduced minutes, like 15 to 20 per game for a little while, and until he kind of sees what.
So basically
what
this entire season for him is a wash.
Yeah, a little bit. Look, I got to tell you, I mean, you know, it's not the same thing, but seeing Blake Griffin undergo another season-ending type of surgery on his knees has got to be kind of a red flag if you're New Orleans. I mean, they're not the same player, but it's another, you know, Zion's another guy that just explodes and plays at the rim and puts a lot of weight down that body when he comes back down. And really, since the beginning of his career, Blake has dealt with significant knee injuries. So if you're the Pelicans, you've got to really slow play this, try to get him back and 100%. So it is in a way kind of a redshirt year for Zion. He'll play, it's no doubt about it, but I don't think he'll be giving you 30, 35 minutes anytime soon.
Good luck with that article. Look forward to reading it. He's Chris Mannix at SI Chris Mannix. We'll talk to you next week, my man.
You got it, Clay.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.